Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, why the way you vote says a whole lot about the way you live. If you've been despairing about the churlish intransigence that characterizes so much of the political debate in Washington, including the standoff about the wall, consider what political scientist Liliana Mason argues in her new book. Partisanship grows irresponsible, she writes, when it sends partisans into action for the wrong reasons. In other words, if it looks like it's all about winning in Washington, that's because that's how we, the voters, mostly want it. A conversation today about how we got there, how to get out of it, and as Professor Mason joins us, I want to hear from you. Are you spending so much time among your kindred spirits in the real and digital community of like-minded people that you've basically got blinders on about the merits of arguments from people with a different political view? They can't all be wrong, can they? I want to hear you think about that. Think out loud with us this morning and call in 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Are you open-minded enough to hear and truly consider the arguments from people who don't share your political views? Is it all about winning, crushing the other side? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Liliana Mason is a political scientist at the University of Maryland College Park and author of a new book, Uncivil Agreement, and she joins us today from D.C. Hi, Liliana. Welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to come back to my suggestion in the introduction that voters are complicit in our zero-sum gain political atmosphere that we're in. I don't want to let voters off the hook here, as we are not going to let the politicians off the hook. You write, if the electorate is moved to action by a desire for victory that exceeds their desire for the greater good, the action is no longer responsible. Speak to where we are right now with the shutdown through that lens.
That's a really good way to look at it. And in fact, there's a part of the book where I specifically address the 2013 shutdown.
Right. And
the similarities between them are actually sort of eerie in that, the goal of the 2013 shutdown was to stop Obamacare from being enacted or to sort of undo Obamacare, which was an unrealistic goal, legislatively, judicially, in every sort of way. It had been approved and was moving forward. And the sort of effect and the point of the shutdown was really to enhance the Republican brand, to make it clear that regardless of whether or not they got the legislative victory that they wanted, they still had control, and they were still sort of winning in the sense that they had power over Democrats in this particular way. And sort of in a similar way right now, what we're seeing is a situation in which, no one really is benefiting from this shutdown. In fact, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people are being hurt by it. But the standoff is not really about finding a position that provides the greatest good for the nation. Instead, the standoff is over who gets to win at the end. And both sides tend to be, really seriously standing strong and firm on the idea that if their side wins, it will be a complete disaster and they must have victory.
But they are not, these political players are not doing this in a vacuum. They are doing this because, and I know a lot of voters are going to sit here and say, I want them to figure it out, come together, make a compromise. But the way we vote and what we demand and the people that we send to Washington behave this way because there's reinforcement from the electorate. Isn't that right?
It actually works in both directions. So one thing that we know about human psychology is that people behave this way always. And we are naturally inclined to wish for victory for our own groups over the greater good. That is one of the sort of more basic findings of social psychology. And over in experiments, this has been demonstrated that people will choose sort of, you know, less reward if they get victory over an out-group. and so that's automatically happening. There's nothing we can do about that. It's a, you know, it's a human motivation. It's a very primal human motivation. And in fact, it actually is what keeps societies together. And so it's not an all bad motivation. The problem is when both the people and the leaders, you know, work entirely on that premise. And so the elites are telling people, you know, this is all about winning. This is, they're focusing on the winning part. They're not focusing on the greater good at all. They're not encouraging people to think more broadly about American identity or, you know, any larger identity that connects people to each other beyond partisanship. And so people are being encouraged by the media or by the media that they, you know, partisan media that they may consume and by their elected officials to think of themselves as partisans first. And therefore, the victory that's most important to them is their partisan victory, not the kind of better, you know, the better outcome for the nation as a whole, the kind of American victory, if you can think of it that way.
Ryan called to say this, and I'm really glad he mentioned the issues here. He says, for me, my ability to reach across the aisle depends on the issue, but it can be hard. Like, I have friends who are flat earthers. Why should I take that seriously? This is one of the big revelations of your book for me, Liliana, which is we think it's about the issues. You know, we think it's all about they don't believe in universal health care. They don't support abortion rights. This political sorting that you're writing about is not about the issues. Why not?
There's so many examples of ways in which people can be made to change their positions almost 180 degrees without even realizing it. And, you know, some of them are, you know, recent examples. If you look at people's positions on trade, for instance, if you look at people's attitudes towards, surveillance, that during the George W. Bush administration, Republicans were fine with surveillance. And then as soon as Obama became president, all of a sudden, Democrats were completely fine with surveillance and Republicans weren't. Right. So people's attitudes can change very, very quickly on what seem to be really important issues to them. And in fact, there's a social psychologist at Stanford named Jeffrey Cohen who ran an experiment in which he randomly assigned welfare positions to the two parties. And one was very stringent and one was very generous. And then he had people come in and he randomly told them, you know, which position their party stood by. And people, you know, relatively reliably took the position that they were told that their party had, regardless of what the position itself was. And then when he asked them if their position had been influenced by their party, their answer was no. I don't think that my position was influenced by my party at all. This is a position that I firmly hold. And then when he asked them to write an op-ed to the local newspaper that might actually be read by their local representative and actually change real policy, people came up with op-eds to write. They came up with multiple reasons to support this position. On the spot, you know, their brains were coming up with explanations for why they held a position that they were just literally given in a lab. And so for so many individuals, even those who believe that they are thinking rationally and they have very, very good reasons to hold the positions that they hold, even for those people, there are biases at work in their, you know, not only subconscious, but also, you know, that are coming at them from outside, from messages from outside, that are interacting with their partisanship and making them change their minds in ways that may be subtle enough that they don't necessarily notice.
Call here from Holly in Hopkins, Minnesota. Hey, Holly, what are you making of this? What's your question?
Oh, well, I've been very distressed by it. And mainly my question is, as a Democrat, I don't feel like it has to be a complete win one way or the other. And I would like to see some sort of package discussion that maybe does include structure in order to give Trump a way out, give him some sort of face to come to the table with. And I'm not sure, maybe that's already happened and they turned it down. I guess that's my question. Is there absolutely no way that other Democrats would support some kind of, let's give some sort of border protection, that if it has to be a structure in some areas, that's what it is. But yeah, by and large, it could be other things like electronic surveillance, other things, more boots on the ground there, around the wall, if that's what it takes. But do we have to have just like one package and that's the only thing he will accept?
We don't have to, but that's where we are. And Liliana, why is that where we are?
So when people feel threatened, when they feel that the status of their group is threatened, that's when they tend to dig in their heels the most. And one thing that Trump was very good at during the 2016 campaign was focusing on the concept of winning. He said it. He said the word winning in almost every single campaign speech that he gave. He said it multiple times. He made it very, very clear that the goal of the election was the victory itself for the people that he was speaking to. And so, you know, Trump himself really elevated this idea of victory at all costs. This, though, then creates a situation in which Democrats feel extremely threatened. And then for them, victory becomes extremely important as well. The idea of introducing some sort of compromise position is a great one. And it would be lovely if, you know, if elected officials were to start trying to behave that way. But it gets their constituents much more excited if they dig in their heels and have a fight, because that creates a sense of threat for everyone. And as long as people feel threatened, they're paying a lot more attention.
Yeah, I want to emphasize this again in case listeners joined us a little late. It isn't that the issues don't matter. It's that a lot of the debate about the issues ends up being a lot of the social and political psychology that you're talking about. Because I think people are going to hear this and say, no, it's pretty obvious. Nancy Pelosi says the wall is an immorality and that's all Trump wants. But there's a lot of other contributors going on here in the shutdown that we see. Is that an okay way to say it?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, a complicating factor here is that the American electorate in general, on average, holds liberal issue positions and identifies as conservative. So there's a mismatch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, they're not, blows, you know, my mind.
The ideological label that someone holds and the positions that they hold don't always match. And so on, you know, if you're trying to appeal to the average American voter, you should talk to them about generally liberal policy positions. But you should also appeal to their identity as conservatives, which is a very difficult thing to do. And so what that incentivizes is actually for Democrats to talk a lot more about policy because they have the left issue positions. And for Republicans, actually, you know, ironically, to talk more about identity, because it's the identification with the idea of being a conservative that really holds people to that label. And that includes not just conservative identity, but Republican identity and white identity, increasingly rural identity, male identity, right? There are all these identities that are mixed together with the Republican conservative identity. And as long as the right emphasizes all of these identities and the threats to these groups that people belong to, they'll pay attention to that more than they'll pay attention to these sort of dry and, uninteresting policy positions that, you know, if all else were equal, they would approve of.
So you've heard this conversation with Liliana develop. You've heard some of the research that is fundamental to the ideas that we're talking about this morning. And I'm going to come back to ask you again whether you are open to high quality argument from people with political views that are different from yours. And what do you think about what she's saying about the psychology of identity, that so often this idea of winning, prevailing, is overriding this sense that, yes, there could be some way to meet on this issue that we all care about. 651-227-6000. Please don't tweet and call just to say, yes, it's the bad guys on the other side and that's all it is. Because this conversation's a lot more than that. I think you can hear that. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Julie in Cottage Grove. Hi, Julie. How are you thinking about this?
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks. taking my call. My point was, and a friend, I'll say I've always been a Democrat, and back years ago, I was happily insured through my family's policy for health insurance. And when the case went before the Supreme Court, and now they ruled that everybody, we're going to require everybody to buy in to the system. You can't opt out. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Everyone has to be. We need a larger risk pool. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm privately insuring myself and I can't afford it. And I'm real, I don't want to have to be forced just by principle.
Mm.
And I'm really healthy. You know, I'm going to opt out of a plan if I'm not going to be fine. So that negative incentive did work for me for a few years. But, you know, so my point is, and I'm very well aware of the hypocrisy in my position, but my point is, I think it comes down to the bottom line, you know, finances. If people really think about it, whether it's Democrat or Republic, it's how it's going to hit me and my family and my pocketbook.
Yeah, personal experience ends up being pretty important. Liliana, how would you factor that in?
So that is an important thing for a lot of people, particularly people who don't feel extremely strongly attached to the party, right? The weaker your partisan attachment, the easier it is to sort of think independently about policy and about your own personal finances. On the other end of the spectrum, for people who are very strongly attached to the party or to the, you know, to the victory of either the party or the racial group that's associated with the party, for those people, often punishing the outgroup is actually more important than, and this is not what I think Holly is saying, but but for many people, punishing the outgroup is more important than preserving your own you know sense of financial ease. And so that's sort of one of those, you know, sort of what's the matter with Kansas type of questions where we see multiple people kind of voting against their own financial interest, specifically because they don't want those people to be getting benefits that they don't think they deserve. And so, but for, I mean, Holly's actually talking about something that I think is almost rare, which is, you know, voting on very specifically your own financial interest. That is increasingly kind of disappearing from the electorate, particularly when we think about the, you know, the like economic anxiety argument about Trump supporters. There's a political scientist named Michael Tesler who pretty convincingly has demonstrated that economic anxiety doesn't drive racial resentment. In fact, it's the other way around. Racial resentment makes people feel more economically anxious, and then that leads to support for the right. And so, you know, just a simple consideration of pocketbook issues is something that we used to think of as very, very normal in American politics and as the main motivator of voters of voting in general. But that type of kind of, you know, independent consideration of that type of issue really is one thing that we've seen disappearing from the electorate in general.
Liliana Mason's book is called Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity, and we're fleshing out some of the ideas. Liliana, your what you wrote about President Obama and the opposition that rose so fast against him in a campaign that seemed where he was you know, cutting through a cross section of politics. This is the best explanation I've read about why that happened the way it did. So I thought we could listen to a little bit of the speech that then Senator Obama gave in 2004 that really elevated his profile, and then talk about what happened.
It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one.
Senator Obama in 2004, he gave Americans a portrait that I think many Americans from different parties wanted to believe in. What happened?
So this story is largely about racial identity. One of the things that happened with the Obama administration is that there had been before Obama, there had been a lot of white sort of rural less educated voters who were who are Democrats and voted for the Democrats sort of no matter what. And then over the course of Obama's presidency, a lot of those people came to think of the Democratic Party as the party of non-white people. And really over the last, you know, since 1964, what we've been seeing is a gradual, what I call social sorting of the two parties, where the Republican Party is increasingly the party of white, evangelical, rural, not entirely men, but, you know, sort of male focused, individuals. And then the Democratic Party has become kind of the party of everyone else. And what that means is that as the parties become racially divided and religiously divided, then what we normally see as wanting my group to win, like partisanship, you know, I want to make sure my party wins. That changes into not only do I want my party to win, but in this election, my party might win, and also my race and my religion and my geographical area and all these things about me that make up part of my identity and who I think I am, they together might win or might lose. And therefore, the stakes of the election become a lot higher. So this hope that everyone would be kind of pulled together into this one, you know, purple America that Obama really convincingly spoke about, it almost was destroyed just by the simple fact of his race, as the race of Obama signaled to people which party they were supposed to be in and who us was supposed to be and who them was supposed to be.
I just want to read a couple lines from that part of the book. I've got it open in front of me. You say, for example, Barack Obama's 2008 Yes, We Can campaign was generally oriented toward hope and change and was the first election in which an African-American was elected president. Republicans, those for whom Obama was the out-group candidate, and now we've heard the analysis about out-groups, had little to openly express anger about. Not only did social norms against racism briefly tamp down open partisan rancor, but it was, after all, a Republican president who had only months before presided over one of the greatest financial disasters in national history. Republicans may have been angry, but in that moment, they were not angry at the relatively unknown Barack Obama. That would come later. I think this explains some of why Democrats and independents who supported Obama were so shocked when Mitch McConnell came right out and said, we're making him a one-term president. I mean, you know, and that was all about out-group, wasn't it?
Yeah. In fact, I think one of the easiest things to point to in terms of, you know, anti-Obama organization is the Tea Party, really had a major victory in 2010 in the midterm elections after Obama was elected. And they, you know, their overt platform was economic conservatism. But in fact, there were some researchers who had been collecting data from 2006 until 2010. So in 2006, the Tea Party did not exist. And what they did was they took the characteristics of people from 2006 and predicted who would become a Tea Party supporter in 2010.
Wow. Huh.
And what they found was that it wasn't economic conservatism that was the most powerful predictor of Tea Party support. In fact, it was social conservatism that was the most powerful predictor. And so while the line of the Tea Party was don't tax us and make sure that, you know, our economy is healthy and strong, really what was driving the Tea Party was this cultural and social anxiety about Obama being president and this feeling of, you know, an out-group member being in charge of us and the threat to the status of, you know, essentially, you know, the white majority of the country.
Right. An out-group candidate that looks like that. Right. And
who
is
looks
that.
Like that. Right.
Yeah.
Regardless of what he says. And it really wasn't about anything that Obama said or did. It was really mostly just about what he looked like.
Call from Alex in New Richmond, Wisconsin. Hi, Alex. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking my call.
What are you thinking about?
Well, you guys have really kind of come to the points I feel are essential when you're trying to analyze what's happening. Just in the last couple of minutes, I think both parties have a real need for their political messaging to be highly recognizable and identifiable. And so they take the most extreme position sometimes rather than trying to find the central aspects. They're also relying on manipulation of the electorate. And the extreme partisanship that seems to me to have driven the Tea Party was kind of engendered by the Koch brothers and all of their, you know, the ALEC organization and various other. And they've ended up coming full circle. And I think the Koch brothers have recognized how much damage they've done and how ungovernable they've made the electorate.
So making a point about how actors outside of the system actually work within this. Let me grab a call here from Sam in southern Minnesota. How do you see this, Sam?
Hi. Well, I just wanted to answer your question of yes, I am willing to listen to the other side as long as it's, you know, an educated and concise argument and a quick story of, I used to be in the Navy, and I was on a ship with a guy and during the Obama and McCain election. And I won't say what side either of us are on, but we were pretty strong on both of our sides. And we had AFN, and AFNs, you know, they doctor what they want you to watch, of course. And we would, you know, and we were both taking college classes, just alerting on the ship on a deployment. We were in the Gulf of Oman flying jets into Pakistan. But anyway, but we would build concise arguments and go back and forth and respect each other and we hear each other out. And I think it's, you know, it's possible as long as it's a solid argument and not just a, this is what I saw and this is what somebody told me.
I hope that, that can only be done on an aircraft carrier where you're, where you have to be there, but it's great practice.
There's a book out there called The Third Option that explains in-groups and out-groups, and if anybody, I heard you guys just talking about that, if anybody wants to know more,
okay.
Called Third Option.
All right. Liliana, what do you hear in his example?
So I think that's a really fantastic example because in, right, if you're both of those people were working for something unrelated to politics with a common goal, and they needed to cooperate regardless of their political views. And so this is one of the things that I tend to recommend in terms of reducing polarization is for people to not talk about politics, or at the very least, before they talk about politics, find a common goal.
Is this,
not just common ground.
Is this what you call contact theory?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
This goes all the way back to 1954, Gordon Allport's book called Prejudice. And his main recommendation for reducing prejudice was for people to be in contact with each other. But there were conditions under which contact works. And one of the conditions is that there is no significant hierarchical difference in status between the two people who are in contact. And another one is that they're both, you know, working towards the same goal. And actually, you know, this theory has really been proven to work relatively well. During the Korean War, the armed forces were desegregated and sort of almost like in a random order by, you know, battalion by battalion. And they found that the white soldiers who were in desegregated battalions actually had higher levels of racial tolerance. So there was an effect of working together, being together in the same place, but importantly, working towards the same goal together. And so, you know, I wouldn't recommend that like every American, you know, be forced to join the military. But you know, in some sense, if we had a national service, right, if there was some, we could have a national service where everyone sort of works on the bridges and roads and fixes the infrastructure together the year after you graduate from high school and, you know, is mixed together with other people who might be unlike you, but you're all working on the same project and you have the same, you know, the same wish for the end of the project. That type of interaction is sort of the only thing that we have left to kind of hope for people to get back together in a place where they can have those conversations.
It's really the antidote to a lot of what you're writing about here, which is this political and social sorting, right? That we are dividing ourselves up and spending so much time with kindred spirits in ways that go far beyond politics. And I think what you've described is the opposite of that.
Exactly. And one of the reasons for, you know, that I think we would need something like that is that, you know, you're exactly right. What we've seen is that Democrats and Republicans are not just different racially and religiously. They're also, you know, they watch different television shows. They drive different types of cars. They drink different types of beer. They, you know, if, in almost every possible consumer area, you can see differences, significant differences between Democrats and Republicans and the choices that they make. And what that really means is that there's a cultural, a deep cultural difference between Democrats and Republicans. And that's very, very hard to overcome unless you start spending some time together and understanding each other's culture.
Here's Philip, who says, please help me understand how the people of Iowa who voted for Obama twice ended up voting for Trump. That's something I continue to grapple with. Liliana, maybe you have a theory about that.
Right. So that is consistent with the idea that over the course of Obama's presidency, it became clearer who white people were supposed to vote for. And it's for Republicans, right? So this is the way that I explain kind of Republican voting and Democratic voting and the asymmetry between these two. If you pick two random Republicans out of the population, the likelihood that they are going to be the same race and the same religion is quite high. If you pick two Democrats randomly out of the population, the likelihood that they're the same race and the same religion is very low, actually.
Yeah.
And so what we have seen is that as people who match the sort of Republican descriptive groupings, if you're white and evangelical and rural, you started during the Obama administration to receive very clear cues, not just from the way the president looked, but also from partisan media and other sources about who you were and where you belonged. And over the course of those 8 years, a lot of people who had sort of not paid a lot of attention to politics before and had kind of, you know, consistently voted for Democrats because their parents did and their grandparents did, people who hadn't been paying a lot of attention but felt very strongly identified as perhaps white or evangelical or rural or all three, those people began to feel that they didn't belong in the Democratic Party anymore. And they, you know, identity-wise, they fit better with the Republican Party. And then not only that, but, you know, despite the fact that Obama really didn't talk very much about racial identity at all,
right,
his simple presence in the office made race salient for people. Trump, on the other hand, made race very salient. He spoke a lot about race and specifically about white identity. And so he made people think about their white identity in a way that they hadn't necessarily previously thought about it. And he made it seem important. And he made it seem like white people were threatened and victimized and that they needed to win again. And that was sort of the important message he kept pushing, was white rural people need to win again. And when that is the message that you hear over and over, you start to think about that group as the most important group for you to support. And the last thing that I'll say is that, you know, we all as individuals have, you know, if not dozens and hundreds of social groups that we identify ourselves with. But the ones that we identify with in any given moment most strongly are the ones that are being threatened, that we feel the status of that group is being threatened. So maybe you feel like you're identified as a resident of your hometown, but you don't necessarily think of that unless people say people from your hometown suck, right? That'll make you feel like, oh, man, now I have to defend my hometown. And so what Trump did was really to put white evangelical rural identity at the top of people's minds and have them defend that as the most important thing that they needed to vote with, as opposed to, you know, a pan-American identity or a liberal policy identity or any of those other things.
Liliana's book is filled with a lot of this great research. We scratched the surface of it, but I think the chapter, Can We Fix It?, is essential reading. Liliana, come back anytime. This was excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The book is called Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!